Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Welcome, John. We're going to talk about the world of space flight and astronomy, your constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky next month, and events at local astronomy societies. But first of all, what's been happening in space flight and astronomy then, John?
Well, hello, Dave. Indeed, yes, quite a lot to talk about. I think I'd like to start with our nearest neighbour, the Moon. In the past, spacecraft have identified what was believed to be ice, and it was been long theorised that ice could exist on the Moon in the deep shadows of craters that are at the north and south poles of the Moon. Because the Moon is hardly angled in its rotation to the Sun, these craters at the north and south pole the floors of those craters never actually see sunlight. They're continually shadowed. So any ice that's been deposited there by cometary strikes or for some other source, possibly internal in the early days of the Moon's life, will remain there. It just won't sublimate away into water vapour. So, as I said, it's been long suspected, and previous spacecraft have believed they've seen it, but that's by reflection. But you could explain that reflection away from just bright deposits of lunar regolith. However, we can now put that to rest. It is definite. Ice is there at both north and south poles of the Moon. Now, this is a joint NASA and Indian space research organisation, because it's a NASA instrument called M3, which is standing for Moon Mineralogy Mapper, and the Indian spacecraft Chandrayaan-1. I hope I pronounced that right. That was launched quite some time ago, in 2008. But all of this data does take time to sift through. But it's been a splendid combination of the Indian spacecraft in the orbits that it's taken, which takes it well over the poles of the Moon, and this mineralogy mapper. It's picked up data that, again, uses the reflective properties you'd expect from ice, but it also measures the way the molecules absorb infrared light. It shines infrared light down to see the difference between liquid water, vapour, or solid ice. And so the data that's been returned, you know, does demonstrate that it's solid ice. So most of the water ice lies in the shadows of the craters, and the temperature there, by the way, I wish I had this in centigrade, but it's minus 250 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm sure, Dave, you could do a quick conversion whilst we're talking. Is not only in the craters. In the north of the Moon, it's also been found spread across the surface in patches as well, sparsely spread, but in patches. So this is going to be very important, learning how it got there, and I suspect cometary interaction, but how it interacts with the lunar environment will be, you know, it's a key focus for NASA and its commercial partners as we start thinking about returning to the Moon, because that water could be used obviously for living purposes, but also it can be used for fuel in combination with other chemicals and so on. By the way, brilliant, Dave has now worked this out. Minus 156 degrees centigrade. Fantastic. What a mathematician. All this on live radio, folks. While we're talking about the Moon, Dave, talking about going back there, this has just had a recent little kick in the sense that American Vice President Mike Pence has been down to a visit at NASA, and he's been encouraging the workers, I think it was at the Johnson Space Flight Center, to get ready for a campaign to return America to the moon. And the target is not the moon surface straight away, but to build a small space station in lunar orbit. And that will act as a gateway for lunar landings, you know, take the crews and the landing spacecraft to the space station, refuel, do all of the necessary preparations, and then descend to the surface and eventually set up a base. But also, it would act as a jumping-off point for deep space missions, such as the projected possibility of getting to Mars. All of that was, of course, planned using the Project Constellation with the Ares rocket and the Orion spacecraft. Now, the Orion American spacecraft survives and is still under development, but probably going to be launched by Falcon Heavy. Something of that sort. Of course, Mike Pence did take the opportunity to have a go at the Obama administration, who were facing budgetary problems, and that was what caused Project Constellation to be cancelled. But it's encouraging that you know, they are firming up their plans to get back to the moon.
Well, I'm sure, you know, Donald Trump's new space force that he's set up, if you remember from a short while ago.
Certainly do.
I expect that to make him progress. And we know he's a Gerry Anderson fan, so I expect he thinks there's a moon base there already, or they can build one straight away. And the Gerry Anderson program UFO would provide an excellent model of how to do it and how to staff it up. No problem.
Wonderful. I wonder if we'll have fake bases on the moon.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Watch out on Twitter.
We'll keep our eyes peeled. Still with NASA, I think one of the things that has been a tremendous success to report on this month is the launch of the Parker Solar Probe. So we're moving now from the moon, of course, to our big neighbour, the sun. So the Parker Solar Probe was launched on the 12th of August, and that used a Delta IV heavy rocket. And that's zooming on its way now, heading for Venus. It's going to get to Venus on the 2nd of October. And that is the fastest that any spacecraft has travelled. It's only going to take something of the order of, 56 or thereabouts days to get from the Earth to Venus. That's a hugely rapid transit. It's going to swing by Venus and then carry on and get to the sun on the 5th of November. Ah, Bonfire Day, an appropriate date.
Very
an
good
auspicious
timing.
One.
Yeah.
Not that the Americans celebrate that, of course. But when it gets to the sun on the 5th of November, it won't be at its final position. On its first meeting with the sun, it'll be 15 million miles from the sun's surface. But that's still three times closer than any other sun-studying spacecraft has ever got. But that's just the first of 24 close encounters that is going to carry the spacecraft down to within 3.8 million miles of the photosphere, the sun's visible surface. It's going to use Venus again to slow down. I think it's going to take six passes of Venus to slow it down gradually as it passes Venus each time. Venus's gravity will interact with the spacecraft, swing it into a slightly different orbit, and remove some of its speed each time until it finally ends up in this orbit, as I say, the closest point of which will be just within 4 million miles of the star's visible surface. Now, of course, being that close to the sun, It's going to be exceedingly hot, but it's going to use a state-of-the-art heat shield, which is going to shield all of the instruments. So it won't be actually be staring at the sun. All of that will be shielded. It will be looking at what it's passed through. That's the way in which it's going to work. But it's going to collect a massive amount of data. No spacecraft has ever attempted to fly so close to the sun. It is going to stay there for, you know, quite a few days on each of its passes. But I think the main thing it's going to be studying isn't the sun's surface itself. It's going to be the corona, which is the sun's outer atmosphere. Although in theory, the sun's outer atmosphere extends, well, way past us, past the orbit of Pluto, as far as the solar wind reaches. You could argue that that is the solar atmosphere. But the corona is that very bright white patch we see round the sun during a total eclipse. We can't see it at any other time. It's just its brightness is wiped out by the brilliance of the sun. But that corona is something that we don't understand. Now, Dave, if you're standing next to a bonfire and you're finding it quite hot, what do you do?
Move further back.
You move further back. Now, on the sun, it's the other way round. If you're standing near the sun, or on the photosphere of the sun, then that's 5,500 degrees centigrade at the surface of the sun. And as you move further away into this corona...
It gets hotter, doesn't it?
It gets hotter, up to several million degrees. Several million. As you go further away...
That's strange, isn't it?
It really is. So that's one of the things that they're going to be studying. There are various theories about how that can be. Things like complex interactions between electrically charged particles and the sun's very powerful magnetic field, or possibly the result of what they call nanoflares, which are small explosions on the sun's surface. And there's millions of those, every second. So countless nanoflares pumping heat into the outer atmosphere, or some kind of combination of the both. As Patrick Moore used to say, we just don't know. So it's...
You're definitely channeling Patrick Moore there.
I haven't got the monocle. but it's probably a combination of both, and that's what we're going to be learning about it.
And you're on the board the spacecraft, so you can do that bit of science yourself.
Oh, I am. I am as well. Yes, I've got a ticket printed by NASA with my name on. It's just one of these little publicity things that they do to help promote astronomy, to help promote science, and anything I can do to join in on that, I think, has got to be good.
You're on board a microprocessor, though, on that spacecraft.
That's
you?
Right. It's just a chip of some kind with several million names encoded on that chip. It doesn't take up an inordinate amount of space or rob them of any capability of carrying extra circuitry for other experiments and so on. And it helps promote. And NASA are hit by budget cuts. Anything they can do to promote science and keep the profile of this kind of research high keeps them in well with Congress, I guess. So
as long as you didn't have to pay for a ticket.
No, I think
no
I might have
on the spacecraft.
On that. One other interesting thing, Dave, about the Parker solar probe is its name, Parker.
Lady Penelope's
There you go. No.
Parker
no.
Pens?
No. No. Eugene Parker. He's an astrophysicist at the University of Chicago. He's still alive now, despite the fact that it was 1958 when he made his proposal about the existence of the solar wind. that I've mentioned, which was groundbreaking at the time. He's 91 now, and he's the only, I think, living scientist to have a space probe named in his honour. And they took him down to the Cape for its launch. It did have to be delayed, I think it was by a day, but you know, he was there, he was fine, and thoroughly enjoyed it. I've got a quote from him here. "I really have to turn from biting my nails and getting it launched to thinking about all the interesting things, which I don't know yet, and which will be made clear, I assume, over the next 5 or 7 years. All I can say is, wow, here we go. We're in for some learning over the next several years." So he's obviously still an enthusiast. So it's carrying four different suites of instruments. One of them, called Fields, is looking at the electric and magnetic fields of the sun. As a wired field imager, photograph the large-scale structure of the corona, and also looking at something I think I've mentioned in the past, coronal mass ejections, the things that can also often cause, well, damage to orbiting spacecraft, but if they strike dead on, but cause the aurora and so on at our north and south poles. Another instrument is called SWEEP, Solar Wind Electrons, Alphas and Protons Investigation. A couple of instruments to look at the particles making up the solar wind. And the last one is the Integrated Science Investigation suite of instruments to measure energies of particles and to learn how they're accelerated to the phenomenal speeds they reach so that they get all the way down to the edge of our solar system. So groundbreaking science going to be done over the next few years. Now, you mentioned InSight, Dave, and yes, I'm on board that one too. I can be in two places at once. I need to report that in August it reached halfway. It's covered 172 million miles. That also reaches its target, the Solar Parker probe. Parker Solar Probe, which gets there on the 5th of November. InSight gets to Mars on the 26th of November. So it's got another 129 million miles to go, and then it'll touch down on Elysium Planitia, where it's going to be studying the planet's deep interior, using studying heat transfer within the ground. It's going to dig a probe into the ground with instruments a couple of metres down. It's good times in terms of NASA's exploration on both InSight and also Parker Solar Probe. But whilst we're at Mars, Dave, I ought to mention Opportunity. Another tremendous success story, of course. That was a rover launched so long ago, 2003, with a 90-day expected lifetime. It's still been working. It's met its 5,000th Martian dawn earlier this year. But it closed down on the 10th of June when the global dust storm covered its panels, its solar panels, with sand. So it can't charge its batteries, and so it's gone into a deep hibernation state, waiting for that solar dust storm to dissipate. However, they've done a detailed analysis of the telemetry received from the rover before it fell silent. And all of that has revealed, you know, good news, that the batteries were healthy and in a good condition. So it's not conclusive, but it indicates that it should weather the storm. The batteries will degrade a little bit in that time, obviously, but not enough to turn it off completely. It should wake up. And they're at the predetermined ping times when they would be expecting to communicate with the craft, they're sending wake-up messages just to see whether it is yet ready to respond. Nothing heard yet, but they keep on going. So several times a week, using the NASA Deep Space Network, trying to see if it can wake up. And then it will move, hopefully the under the power stored in its batteries, hopefully that movement will shake off the dust from the panels and it can start to recharge its batteries. Of course, the other rover that Endeavour is not affected because it doesn't use solar power. That's got its own internal nuclear isotope which powers it. So I suppose we ought to move from America to Europe and our European Space Agency, and in fact to Britain, because they've just had an excellent success which should benefit all of us, a mission called Aeolus. It's a spacecraft that weighs about 3,000 pounds. It was actually built in Stevenage by Airbus Defence and Space. They have a manufacturing plant in Stevenage. It's the same basic kind of satellite bus as was used on the Rosetta mission and also the Mars Express mission. So both of those ESA probes, they have a standard kind of satellite design, multi-purpose satellite. So now this, what this is going to do for us, it's going to be measuring wind in the Earth's atmosphere. Hence its name. Aeolus was the keeper of the winds. A name I can feel some empathy with. I think that that's I'd best move
on. No comment.
But this satellite was launched by the European Space Agency's Vega rocket, which is effectively a lightweight launcher, light to medium weight launcher. Solid fueled rocket motors with an upper stage with liquid propellants to finally put the satellite into orbit. So it's gone into a polar orbit about 200 miles above the Earth's surface, and it's in a an orbit that is sun synchronous. In other words, it flies just above the dawn nighttime divide. It flies just where the sun is rising. As it goes round, it'll keep at that sort of angle, and it will shine high-powered lasers down, measuring wind flow and air currents across the whole of the atmosphere, up to about 100,000 feet. Now, in the past, weather satellites have tried to measure wind, and they've also used balloons, of course, to measure wind speeds at lower levels. But the way earlier satellites did it was to track clouds, know the height of the cloud, know the speed of the cloud, therefore they know the speed of the air and the wind at that particular level. But this one will be able to do it throughout the atmosphere, for the whole of that part of the atmosphere it's looking at. So this is quite a step change in terms of providing information of wind speed over both ocean and land masses for weather prediction models. That's going to be providing better weather data for better weather forecasting over the next few years. And we'll all benefit from that, I'm sure. And we, of course, can't go without mentioning SpaceX, Dave, can we? We always do. So they've, business as usual, in some senses, they've just used one of their previously flown Falcon 9s to launch an Indonesian communication satellite, and a Dragon capsule, which first flew 2 years ago to the ISS and was recovered and launched again at the end of June. That's just detached from the International Space Station, completing its resupply mission, and has splashed down successfully, been recovered with 12 tons of cargo, experiments, etc. on board, and will be refurbished and reused again. Now, something new, though, on the SpaceX front is that NASA has just signed off their plans about launching the Crew Dragon, which is the crewed version of this Dragon spacecraft. What SpaceX have proposed is that all of the put the crew into the spacecraft at the launching bay, and then load up the fuel, and that's much less risky than fueling the rocket before the astronauts arrive at the launch pad. If there was a mishap on the launch pad during fueling, then the Crew Dragon's abort rockets would be armed and could immediately fire the capsule and its crew away from the pad. And it would also be a lot safer for ground support teams. It would ensure that they're at a safe distance away from the rocket during fueling. And so that has been signed off. So that's a milestone in the development of the commercial launch capability to the International Space Station, you know, returning American capability of launching its own astronauts rather than just relying on the Russian Soyuz resupply vessel, launch vessel. SpaceX have also had another milestone in that's adding the astronaut walkway to the launch tower they've been using on Pad 39A at the Kennedy Space Center, Cape Canaveral. That's so that the astronauts can now go up on a lift and in this tower and then walk out to the spacecraft, as we used to see with the Apollo missions. Things are moving up on this idea of commercial space launches, because it's not just SpaceX that were given a contract to launch. It's also Boeing. And they have a craft called the Starliner. The CST-100 Starliner, and that is almost ready to go as well. And there was a recent ceremony at the Johnson Space Flight Center in Houston, and NASA announced the names of the first nine astronauts who would be flying the first four flights. That's two in SpaceX's Crew Dragon and two in the Boeing Starliner. So, as I say, it's the first time since 2011 that they're nearly in the position of using American rockets to launch American astronauts from American soil. So a big thing, obviously, for the Americans, the NASA administration, and the government. So the first captain named is Chris Ferguson, who he was the chap that flew the final flight of the shuttle Atlantis, and he now works for Boeing, and he'll be one of the three person crew on that first flight, which is scheduled for May. He'll be joined by a couple of other astronauts, one of them a shuttle pilot and another one is a rookie. And then they'll have two astronauts in the Crew Dragon. That's actually going to launch earlier, according to the current timettable. That'll be April 2019. That's Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley. Doug Hurley's a former shuttle pilot. Bob Behnken's done several spacewalks. And they will both fly to the International Space Station and stay for a little while, testing out these new spacecraft. They will be flying unmanned missions using those spacecraft as precursor tests. So those launch dates I've just quoted, May and April, might, of course, slip in the light of whatever they learn from those unmanned tests. The Boeing capsule is going to go up on a Atlas V rocket from Cape Canaveral. And the SpaceX Crew Dragon will, of course, launch on their own Falcon 9. Once they are flying on a regular basis, the idea is that all of the American craft, the Crew Dragon and the Starliner, when they launch on a regular basis, each one will have a Russian cosmonaut on board, and all Soyuz flights will launch with a NASA flight engineer on board. And that ensures that there'll always be someone that's an expert on the relevant equipment on the space station, some of it American, some of it Russian. Right, final article today, Dave, is taking us out a little bit further, a long, long way further. One of my favourite things to look at in the night sky are called globular clusters. These are dense aggregations of stars, usually very, very old stars, that are packed closely together, gravitationally held, roughly in a ball shape, hence their name, globular clusters. Now, the biggest one of those, unfortunately, isn't visible from Northern Hemisphere. Our biggest close one that we can see is called the Hercules Cluster, Messier M13. But the biggest one is Omega Centauri. That is, you know, so big and bright that it can be seen by naked eye. But it thought initially to be a bit of a fuzzy star, but it is a massive star system containing something of the order of 10 million stars, all of those packed into a globe, if you like, 86 light years across. Now, that is very, very dense. So just to give you a comparison, our nearest star is 4.2 light years away, Alpha Centauri system. In the core of the Omega Centauri, the stars are just 0.16 light year apart. So you can imagine what it would be like were there to be planets around some of these stars, and with the night sky absolutely packed with hundreds of thousands of close, bright stars. So that's actually been the theme of some science fiction stories. All of that has just been blown away, I'm sad to say. A team of researchers from the University of California, Riverside, and San Francisco State University have been studying these stars. They've studied the motions of 350,000 of the stars in Omega Centauri, which is, as I say, Southern Hemisphere. They studied the motions of them, and they have discovered that the movements of these would cause so much disruption that any forming protoplanetary disks are likely to be broken up. So it's highly unlikely that planets would form around stars at least in the core of such systems. And therefore, if no planets, then no life either. But I suppose there is the hope that in some of the smaller globular clusters, where there will be less interactions, gravitational interactions, maybe life might have evolved. Okay, a couple of extras for you. Back in our solar system, asteroid missions. There's two underway at the moment, a NASA one called OSIRIS-REx and a Japanese one called Hayabusa 2. So a little bit of news on both of those. Hayabusa 2 is now station keeping, flying alongside its target asteroid, which is called Ryugu. So it's just 12 miles from Ryugu. That's its point it's stopping at, whilst it studies and selects a landing site, which I believe they've just proposed. It dropped to just half a mile from the asteroid to have a much closer look. Now, Europe is involved in this as well. Although it's a Japanese mothership, we've got a lander on board called Mascot. And that's very small, just 12 inches by 12 inches by 8 inches. And that's going to land on Ryugu in early October. It's just going to settle down, and once it's done its studies, it's got a, if you like, it's like a toy, you know, with a spring underneath. Its leg will spring and flip it, and because the gravity is so small, it'll just float, and eventually the gravity of Ryugu, tiny gravity, will bring it down gently again, and it'll be on a different part of the asteroid.
So this is a sort of a shoebox with a jack-in-the-box spring.
Yeah, if you like.
Zebedee. It should be named Zebedee. Every Boing. So often it just boings itself off to elsewhere. On the... Very clever.
But in space, nobody can hear you scream and no one can hear you boing. Now, there's the other American space probe to an asteroid. In this case, the asteroid is called Bennu, and the OSIRIS-REx mission is well on its way there, and it's just taken its first images of Bennu. Hayabusa will return asteroid material to Earth next year, if all goes well. OSIRIS-REx, when it returns with its samples from Bennu, I don't think that's until 2022, so a bit longer to wait. But whilst we're in you know, the solar system, let's go right out to the very edge of the solar system. You'll remember, Dave, of course, that 3 years ago, NASA's New Horizons spacecraft flew past Pluto with fantastic results, amazing images that were sent back, a huge amount of data. We've learnt so much. But because it was still in good order and still going, they thought, well, shame to throw it away. Let's find somewhere else for it. Let's see if we can alter its trajectory just enough so that it can not land, but zoom past another object. Now, the objects out at that distance from the solar system are called Kuiper Belt objects. You know, the remnants of the stuff that made the solar system, you know, 4.5 billion years ago. And they identified one that wasn't too far off track, a slight adjustment to the orbit, and it's now heading to Ultima Thule. It's 100 million miles away from Ultima Thule, but it's closing at about nearly a million miles a day, and it's now sighted its target. It's sent back its first picture of the target a lot earlier than was expected, and it's going to go past on the 1st of January. But we really are talking a huge distance. We don't really use millions of miles when we get out that far, because it becomes almost meaningless. Instead, we use a unit called the astronomical unit. Now, the one astronomical unit is the average distance from the Earth to the Sun, 93 million miles. Now, this Ultima Thule, at the closest it gets to the Sun, is 42 astronomical units away. And it's a highly elliptical orbit. It goes also as far out as 46 astronomical units. So we'll be scratching at the far edges of our solar system. So that's it.
Thank you, John, for the update.
So that's...
Stars Over Surrey, Constellation of the Month.
So, John, what's your constellation of the month?
And the constellation for the month of September, Dave, is Cygnus. Some people call it the Northern Cross, just to equate it to the Southern Hemisphere's Southern Cross. So the arms of the cross are the outspread wings of the swan, Cygnus the swan. The long tail of the cross is, in fact, the outstretched neck of the swan, and the brightest star, Deneb, is in the tail at the very top of what would be the cross. So it's home to some splendid Messier objects, some wonderful double and multiple stars, and I've described all of this in a bit more detail on the video clip available on the website.
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey.
Now, John, so what will our listeners be able to see in the night sky over the next month?
OK, Dave, well, lots of good summer objects still there to be seen. And as the night wears on, you're starting to get some of the winter objects coming up, and winter constellations as well. So it's a good time of the year. We're starting to get darker evening sky, so we can start our observing just that little bit earlier. Constellations, previous constellations of the month, like Hercules and Lyra, are still there, relatively high in the sky. My constellation for this month, Cygnus, more or less dead overhead at 10 o'clock. What's coming up is Pegasus and Andromeda, so opportunities to find the Andromeda galaxy, M31. The Milky Way is also good at this time of year. If you live in a place away from light pollution that allows you to see the Milky Way, because that runs straight through the middle of Cygnus, so more or less overhead, then heading down towards Cassiopeia and Perseus. Planets, we've still just about got the four main planets, about which a little bit more, but let me first of all give you the appropriate dates for moon watching. Well, if you're wanting to be out there observing the deep sky objects, then do that around the 9th of September, because that's when we have a new moon. If you're up early, then you can observe the moon best about the 2nd of September, when it's in its third quarter. But for looking at the moon's craters, etc., I would do it around the 16th. That's when it's at first quarter. And forget about doing much astronomy when it's full moon, because it's so bright it washes out all bar the brightest stars. That's on the 24th. But a lot of people like to look at the new moon, so why not? But let's get on to the planets. Mercury, we've lost that as an evening object, but it's now visible, but only for the first 2 weeks, as a morning object. So that's a nice bright spark rising in the east-northeast before dawn. Venus, Mars, Saturn, and Jupiter are all there as evening objects. Venus, first of all, only for, again, about the first half of the month. Still brilliant, magnitude -4, and that's in the west-southwest. But even at the start of the month, it sets less than an hour after sunset at the start. And as the month draws on, it's getting lower and lower. So it disappears really into the twilight at about the middle of the month. Next planet out from Earth is Mars, of course, and that's putting on a great evening show. Despite being relatively low, it's only 11 degrees high at its highest, so you do need an uninterrupted by trees and buildings view, a good flat low horizon to the south. It is moving away from the Earth, or the Earth is pulling away from Mars, so it is dimming and getting slightly smaller by the end of the month. So at the start of the month, its magnitude would be minus 2.1, and it goes down to minus 1.3 at the end. But that's still bright, still bright. So it's well worth looking at. And despite the dust cloud, it's still a good orangish-red colour. Jupiter. Still just about with us as an evening object, low in the southwest, but again, start of the month, just like Venus, getting lost in the twilight as the month draws on. But both of those will come up as morning objects within a couple of months. Saturn, still there, looking wonderful. Not as bright, of course, because it's so far away. So magnitude plus 0.9, low in the southern sky. But it's a great object because the rings are nicely tilted towards us. If you want to try and find it, then, you know, use a star map. Use the appropriate software like Stellarium. Oh, there's plenty of apps on your phone, like Sky Safari, etc., that will help you find your way to Saturn. Do it in the first half of the month, because it will be better then. Our two furthest planets, which aren't really naked eye at all, Uranus and Neptune, both of those can be seen with binoculars if you know where to look. Visible all month, Uranus, at mag 5.7, so you can see it's a bit of a challenge. That's in the southeast to the south, early hours of the morning. But by the end of the month, as it rises earlier and earlier, it will become an evening object by the time we end the month. Neptune, it's the best time all year to see Neptune is September. And that's nice and high, about 30 degrees above the horizon in the south. But its magnitude is 7.8, so very faint. So you do need a good star map with a marker to show where Neptune can be found against that that pattern of stars. So a bit of a challenge. Events of interest for September. We've got a faint comet that can be seen in binoculars, and by the time it gets to its brightest, it might possibly be naked eye. But on the 2nd of September, if you can find your way to the star called Capella in Auriga, and all star maps will show that, then you'll find it. It's called Comet 21P Giacopini-Zinna, and it passes 1 degree southwest of Capella on the 2nd. At magnitude 7, so you can't see that with the naked eye, so you do need binoculars. On the 5th, and I've provided a star map in the slide set that supports this, but if you can find your way to Saturn, then it will also help you to find three Messier objects. Saturn is positioned between three of them. M21, an open cluster, is just over a degree away from Saturn. Just under 2 degrees away is the Trifid Nebula, M20. And the Lagoon Nebula, M8, is a bit further away still, just over 2 degrees from Saturn. So if you can find your way to Saturn, then M21 and M28 will be to the right-hand side, as you look at it, as Saturn, but about at the same height. M21 right next to it, M28 a little bit lower, and the Lagoon Nebula, M8, a little bit lower still. So this part of the sky is a wonderful part of the sky. There's plenty of other messier objects to be found there as well. M23, 4, 5, M28, there's plenty. It's just above the constellation called Sagittarius, and a group of stars within Sagittarius are shaped giving rise to the name the teapot, that they really do make up a teapot. There's a lid, a spout, a handle. Once you see the set of stars, you'll understand why. But what's interesting is that out of the teapot spout comes the steam of the Milky Way. That's where the Milky Way is at its thickest. So it's quite a nice analogy. Saturn just happens to be placed there, and as it's relatively bright, find your way to Saturn, and then with binoculars, search the sky near it, and you'll find these wonderful objects. On the 9th, we've got a couple of meteor showers, but don't get too excited. They're low hit rate meteor showers, only a few meteors per hour. But given that both of them occur on the same night, you've got a better than average chance of seeing some meteors. So there's the Piscids and the Epsilon Perseids. Back to comet Giacopini-Zena again on the 12th. It passes another messier object, M37. That's an open cluster in Auriga. When you look at the moon on the 13th, you'll find that that is very close and makes a nice picture with Jupiter. Jupiter will just be 6 degrees below the moon. So that will make a nice photograph. On the 15th, the same comet, Giacopini-Zena, passes close to M35, which is an open cluster of stars in the constellation of Gemini. On the 17th, Saturn and the Moon are very close together. And on the 19th, it's the Mars, planet Mars, that is relatively close to the Moon, 5 degrees away from it. To help you find Neptune, if you use the Moon to help you find your way to planets, on the 23rd, the Neptune is just under 4 degrees northwest of the Moon. And the Moon will make a nice picture for you on the 30th. I've mentioned in the past a cluster of stars called the Hyades in Taurus the Bull. And the Hyades are what make up the V of the horns and the face of the bull, the base of the horns. So the moon will be just central within that V of stars. So that make quite a nice picture, but it doesn't reach that position until just before dawn. So it's not an evening opportunity, it's a dawn shot that you need to take if you're doing a photograph. And now local societies. Guildford Astronomical Society start off their new season, 2018-19 season, on Thursday the 4th of September at 7:30. And the talk is Hawking, Black Holes and the Edge of Physics. That's by Paul Fellows from the Institute of Astronomy at Cambridge. The 14th of August, chap I've heard talk many times, Professor Andrew Coates from Mallard Space Science Laboratory, part of University College London, he'll be talking at Farnham AS at Aldershot Cricket Club on Tuesday the 14th with latest results from Cassini. Cassini has burnt up, of course, but there's so much data that they'll be processing that, they reckon, for the rest of the century. So it's what has been learnt of late. Another two large astronomical societies within the area, Croydon and Yule. And I'm sorry, I can't give you details as yet. Yule have got a talk by Sarah Bosman. The title is yet to be agreed. I think Sarah is one of their own members. But Croydon, their website doesn't yet post the title or speaker. But that would be on Friday the 7th of September, and Yule is Friday the 14th of September. So watch their websites if you live near. I'm sure they'll be posted soon. And for astronomy on TV, our old favourite, the BBC Sky at Night, is looking at these American and Japanese attempts to return bits of asteroid to us that I've already mentioned. So it's called Expedition Asteroid. This month's episode looks at the alarming number of space rocks that are currently orbiting close to the Earth, and the US and Japanese attempts to return chunks of asteroid to Earth, and the UK-wide network of detection cameras that has been set up with the specific aim of imaging a falling meteor. And a couple of the guys at Farnham Astronomical Society are quite active in this network of filming bolides and meteors that are falling through the air. They use all sky cameras, 360-degree cameras. Leave it running all night and have a look in the morning to see what's been seen. Anyway, the programme is on Sunday, the 9th of September, at 10 o'clock on BBC Four, and on Thursday, the 13th of September, is the repeat, again on BBC Four, at 7:30. So there we are, Dave. That's my news and what's up for September.
Thank you very much, John, for the fascinating insights. This show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will also have more items that we couldn't fit into the broadcast. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be on Friday, 28th of September. Thank you, John.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemetis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not keep up to date with the Sound of Surrey by listening live at brooklandsradio.co.uk or through our free mobile app.